I'm here. I'm putting in my headset.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you good. Everyone else?
Great.
How's it going, Mike? This is Bill.
Bill, my name is Mike. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Mike.
Hi, this is David.
David, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Have I emailed with any of you besides Alan?
I don't believe so, Mike. I definitely have been aware of your work. Predominantly through Christopher Knowles' different sites and groups. So I'm probably more aware of you than you are of me, but it's really great to have you on the show.
And what are we live right now?
No, there's no live. We're record on Skype, and then we'll put it up. Then we'll edit it and put it up.
Oh, good. Great. That's great to hear. I'm all for that.
Just for the record, we do very little in the way of editing unless there's something specific. The show became called Always Record because we found that there's these sort of nuggets in there, and this is a little more long form, but it's sort of, we let it flow naturally. And but if there's something particularly that you'd like removed, just say the word, and we can always make that happen.
Great. I say the same thing when I start my show. So
awesome.
All right, is everyone sort of set up here?
Yep.
Good to go.
Okay, here we go. Before we start, Mike, I just want to sort of throw something out at you. This is no pressure, no anything, but just to let you know that you're a very popular and wanted man. We have a sister radio program, you might call it, that goes on Tuesdays, different hosts. It's called 42 Minutes. They do specifically a 42-minute interview show.
And that's the fellow out of Boise?
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah, I've emailed with him back and forth a little bit. I've never followed up on much, so.
Okay. I told them that I just happened to mention that we were having you on, and I spoke to Doug in one phone conversation, and he was, like, so jealous that we were having you on. And then last night, or the night before, I spoke to Will Morgan, the other co-host, and I happened to mention it, and he was also incredibly jealous that we were having you on. So you might get an email from them sometime in the near future or whatever. Usually we don't line them up back and back because we kind of do a joint, you know, like I said, it's like sister programs. So just to let you know that they were both very jealous that we were getting to speak with you today.
Okay, good. Well, I think I've connected with both of them online. That's when I asked, you know, have I the two folks here? And what, here, just give me the names one more time of the two people that you're with.
My name's Bill.
And this is David.
And do you have blogs or anything that I may know of?
You might know of. We do have blogs.
Okay.
New Creatures Magical Mystery Tour.
And that's yours, David? That's...
Yes.
And let's drop the links if you want to go to the Skype. Or...
Sure.
I'm going to try not to multitask, online, so I end up sounding really lost when I do that. So.
Well, I'll tell you what. Here, let's make it easy. There, the site for this is thesyncbook.com/alwaysrecord. That should work. Whenever you click on that, that's where the shows are saved. And at the top there, for each person's name, is a link to their blog if you click on the name. So that's probably the easiest way to do it.
Great.
I think, Bill, if I'm not giving away any big secret here, you also were in the Secrets on Facebook group. You guys might have interacted there, yes?
Yeah, definitely. That was I spent, and this is the highest compliment possible, way too much time in that group for about, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 months, being such a huge fan of Chris's work, and then having the group, I know he had dropped, not hints, but he just always alluded to the fact that his group was, God, my voice is so shredded from last night. The group was really where a lot of the action was going on as far as following or continuing the conversation. And when I, when he invited, he, you know, accepted my request to be in that group, my God, I got lost in there. It was really...
The group on the... On the Facebook group for The Secret Son?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I just... obsession is a light word. I just... It consumed me. It was just an incredible, non-stop, 24-hour-a-day, just whirlpool of information. And I basically came to a point where I kind of had to step away from it for a while. But I definitely hope to poke my head back in there again soon. But definitely, it was a really great way to discover other people's voices in real time, you know, just the way the comments and conversations evolved. And definitely Mike was a good presence in that group as well.
Good. You know, I probably have connected with you at some form or another back and forth on that. What was I going to say? Oh, and that guy Cosmic Comics shows up on that, and I think he got interviewed on, it might have even been 42 Minutes. I'm not sure. I can't remember. I don't know his real name. I've connected with him under the pseudonym Cosmic Comics. He's a pretty funny guy.
Yeah, we had him on a few weeks ago, and because actually he was on 42 Minutes, and I just heard him speak, and I was like, oh, I would actually, you know, again, I've interacted with him on Facebook, and just getting to hear him speak and sort of expand on some of his ideas, I realized he was someone who was very well-researched and just very interesting to talk to. Really interesting guy. He also goes by the name Frank Zero.
That's right. Frank Zero. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
You know, Mike, this actually, since we're talking about Facebook, there was something, you know, you could take this, I hope you take this as a compliment. I'm going to tell you a quick little story. The whole, when I was speaking to these guys about, you know, about the 42 minutes and reaching out to you, I told Doug this story, which is that I had also seen you, I was exposed to your work through Chris Knowles, following Chris Knowles' blog, seeing you post in the comments there, seeing that you had interviewed him. I enjoyed the interviews you did with him so much. And talking to you, you know, so interacting a little bit on the Facebook group there for Secret Son, and I sent you a Facebook friend request, and it went probably a good year or so without you responding to it. And every now and then I would go, I was like, oh, I must not have sent it. And I would go to check and it says still pending request.
Oh, I have hundreds. You know, that's funny. I kind of am very cautious to you know, who I, you know,
well,
reply to and stuff. So.
Precisely. That's just it. So when you asked me to do your show, you know, one day I just get a, Mike Cleveland has accepted your friend request, and then a message, hey, would you like to come on the Hidden Experience show? So, you know, I was a little taken aback at first, but I have to say, after doing a year of what I've been doing for the Sync book, sort of all this promotion, you get bombarded with these friend requests of people that I've never met, and then you don't end up interacting with them. I have to say, as I said, I hope you take it as a compliment. At first, I was a little taken aback, and then I've come to realize that you do this really intricate dance that I have immense respect for, because you've managed to find a way of having really good personal boundaries, you know, particularly in that Facebook arena, even emails and things like that, just setting up good personal boundaries. And yet, when it comes to your blog and your podcast, you are so open, so incredibly open, that your heart is on your sleeve, sharing very intimate experiences, but with details that you're wanting to share, and just guarding certain names and things like that. And of course, so everything we do is a very fine line that we're always dancing on, but I think you do it exceptionally well, and I just wanted to let you know that I have immense respect for what you do, that you, on a personal level, have those boundaries, which I've come to realize are incredibly needed, and yet, when it comes to the show, there's this sort of no-holds-barred, really letting go of the experiences, which is what you really want to get to. You know, let's not talk about, you know, I don't want to see pictures of your cat on Facebook. I want to talk about these experiences. And but really diving into them and really being open about them. And I just have immense respect for the way you've handled yourself.
Great, great. It's funny, the openness on the podcast series is, I almost entered this arena and kind of like realized that the, like, you, one had to be as honest as they could be. And so that was in a way sort of a mission statement as I went into this, you know, in that realm, as being as honest as I could be. And that includes being honest about my own, like, questioning. You know, there's a lot of folks out there who are, you know, very, you go to a UFO conference and there's a lot of folks that are really gushing with, you know, like, they connect the dots a little too quickly with their own experiences, and then they're a little too quick to believe in everything. And I just, that's just not me. So, you know, when I am being honest, at the same time, I'm saying like, oh, well, I'm struggling with this and it's, you know, it's complicated and I, you know, here's what I see, but I don't quite believe it, you know? So yeah, I know what you're talking about, and I work hard to do that. And it, so, yeah. So thank you.
Yeah, and I think there's something else that's another quality there, which is, as you say, even a lot of the researchers or experiencers will come out with a very, almost, you know, storybook, I hope that's not insulting, but it's this almost storybook, this happened, this is the agenda, whether it be government agents or reptilians, or I'm being haunted by this interdimensional species, or whatever it might be. They have a sort of script that they're following. I don't mean that. I hope you understand what I mean. And I think, and that always, you know, these are really funny waters that we're swimming in to begin with, but that's always a huge red flag for me. And I think in any of this, whenever someone comes out too specific that they know, you know, we should never get to the point where we don't want to say, hey, this is my opinion, or I've researched this and I have a really strong feeling about such and such. I don't want to become so loose that we're unable to say anything. But at the same time, I just think there's something so ultimately honest and ultimately almost truthful that there is something that remains unable to be known, and to continue a questing and a questioning rather than spouting some sort of official answer or this is the truth I've come to.
Well, I mean, yeah, we're dealing with a genuine mystery, and you know, that mystery is, you know, I feel like we as humans, or we know these little flawed creatures walking around in three dimension on this earth, are somehow interacting with something that's beyond that. You know, whether that's synchronicity, or whether that's a ghost story, or whether that's premonitions, or whether that's UFO abduction lore. You know, it's an interaction with something that's beyond our ken. It's beyond our ability to even, it's not that we're having trouble understanding it. It's that we simply could never understand it, the same way that a octopus could never understand a mountain goat. You know, you could put them in the same room together somehow, but that, you know, even that doesn't work. You know, because the octopus can't be in the same environment as the mountain goat. So you get that inference, when you start making assumptions and things like that, I'm sure the octopus would say like, oh, well, it's just a different kind of octopus, you know, which it's not, you know, when thinking about the mountain goat. But we're struggling to make sense of something that we may never, ever be able to make sense of just because of our reality. Maybe when we die, we go through the white light and everything becomes clear and we understand these mysteries. But you know, in this form that we're in right now, you know, whatever, it just ain't going to happen. So that struggle is part of the overall experience. That struggle to understand.
I like how in your chapter in Sync Book 2, you had expressed synchronicity as a means of communication when it came to what, for lack of a better word, we were calling extraterrestrials. I like the idea of synchronicity as a means of communication.
Well, what, I said it in that essay where there's folks out there that I've talked with and interacted with, and they, and it was interesting. I went, you know, I make an effort to contact people and call people and talk to people on the phone, and you know, in order to do that, you have to have like a 4-hour conversation to, before you even really start to understand what they've been through. And that was something that was coming up over and over again, you know, because I'll ask about synchronicities and people will say that that they sense that synchronicity is communication.
Right. Well, it's a universal thing, right? So it's like it's a kind of language that you could understand. So if you're talking about like an octopus and a billy goat, how do they communicate? What's the common language? Synchronicity is a common language, and it gets right to the heart of things. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it can tell you to turn right or left on the path or something. Yeah, so it can give you a little heads up on you know where you're proceeding. And oftentimes the synchronicity, I mean, synchronicity by its very nature has to be personal. There can't really be a group. I guess there could be group synchronicities, but you know the synchronicity is happening to one person, and that person alone is the one who needs to decipher it.
You know, I was in psychoanalysis for a couple of stretches in my life. And I went to the same person for the therapy, and they were both about 1 year long stretches. And ultimately, he kept returning to a certain, for lack of a better word, truth of this psychoanalytic process that he was involving me in, was that he was trying to get me to consider that the things that were affecting my life happened at such a young age that I can't even remember them, right? That they were formative experiences and formative occurrences that happened to me and my physical structure when I was maybe 2, 3, or 4 years old, and that I just don't have a conscious memory of those things. And he kept working back to that kind of notion when I would ask these certain questions about why this, why that. And I always was thinking, well, so you're the person who will find this for me, or you're the person who will know this about me, or you're going to fill in this blank space in my unconscious slate for me. Like, that's why, my parents were paying you good money for me to go to psychoanalysis. And I think over the years, if I had had more experience in this field and I had had a better vocabulary and a better database to reflect upon what was going through my head, it's starting to dawn on me that what Jung was saying with synchronicity is that this is the language that taps you into that those spaces, that uncanny things reflect back upon you in such a profound, unexplainable way that when you start to decipher what that moment is, what it's trying to say to you is that maybe that is how you tap into those parts of your unconsciousness that seemingly are completely out of your grasp. So, and then you can really just take giant leaps out of that structure and say, well, are there, if you want to believe that, you know, once you go through that clear white light, what remains is still you, and that has happened in a recursion, then maybe some of these synchronicities happened before this identity, and maybe some of those synchronicities tap into things that are yet to come. So is that a framework for synchronicity that sort of makes sense to you? Is that sort of where you're coming from with synchronicity as a language?
Well, I guess so. You know, it's, you know, what you're saying to me sort of, you know, like one thing I say all the time when in my writing, and I'll talk about it, is that like you have to, you know, there's always a wrestling act between your intellectual pragmatic mind and your gut instinct and your intuitive mind. And there comes a point almost where you have to throw out the pragmatic and just trust the intuitive. And that to me says, you know, synchronicity. And that almost defines the poet in a way, you know. So as you go down this path, you know, it seems like looking to the accredited scientist, the theoretician with the that, you know, works in academia, you know, those, that's not, that might not be where you get the answers. You may get the answers from the poet at the outskirts of society, you know, the person that's kind of laughingly dismissed. I mean, literally the village idiot at times is where you're going to find your best clues. And in a way, what you were just describing, as far as that, you know, to me, that seemed like, you know, you were all almost saying, you know, like you need to tap into the poet rather than the, because I think if you tried to intellectualize it, you would just grit your teeth and spin your wheels and get stuck.
Yeah, absolutely. Because intellectually, none of this shit makes sense. So intellectually, why would you spend time moving forward in an area that has no concrete specifics to it? But yeah, I mean, if the poet can flow in and out, on top, above, below, and around it in multitudes of ways, then the energy of the event, it starts to deliver something that seems to give off a positive effect, or at least some sort of momentum to living. So that there's value there.
Yes, and the poet can leapfrog past the intellectual mind and just go right to the gut and speak in metaphor and speak in, you know, in ways that don't linear in any kind of linear way don't connect to your higher mind. Well, let's say don't connect to your logical mind. Yeah, but you would leapfrog right to the intuitive mind.
So there's two possible ways to go with this, but it's so funny because this is I don't know if you heard me saying I really didn't sleep last night. I've barely been sleeping lately because of trying to wrap up Sync Book 2 and everything. So I found myself at about 9 a.m. I still hadn't gone to sleep, and I'm just kind of, my head sort of spinning, and I couldn't concentrate on my work anymore. And I just found myself in this almost trance-like, just meditative state that, I don't know, it's that hypnagogic, this kind of just over-drowsy, whatever state. And I found myself really thinking, just reflecting on my experiences within this community and just my own thoughts and all this material and all the different approaches that we take to it. And I just kept coming back to this really interesting almost phrase that you guys are talking about now, which is that the only real way to approach this subject is as an artist, that the science seems limited. It has to find a way to kind of box it in somehow to explain it or to quantify it or qualify it or any of those things. So the science is lacking. Even the mystical side, I find, sometimes gets overly dogmatic. But the artist is able to really run with it and speak in that same language that the synchronicity speaks in, the language of metaphor, of symbolism, all that. And I'm wondering, Mike, I know you are a fantastic visual artist. Do you find that your, I don't know, maybe like the way your mind thinks artistically has helped you process synchronicity better?
You know, it probably has, but, you know, I think that what my mind has always done, you know, and I guess the artistic thing, I the creative side, you know, yeah, that creative element, you know, and there's always been the side of me that, like smart people that are scientists and create academic reports and such, you know, I'm always really bored with that, you know, like I that just makes me kind of roll my eyes and just like seize up and just like, ugh, you know. So it's less that I'm using that creative side, and it's more that I'm just bored with the intellectual side and then just, you know, kind of want to push that away and jump right into the heartfelt emotional stuff rather than the cold clinical analytical stuff.
Okay. I think dispassion for one thing can often be passion for something else, you know.
Sure, sure. Yeah, one one side of an equation, you know, contracts and the other side of the equation expands. Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's the other sort of idea that popped up in that. The idea of synchronicity as a communication, this is a question I've been asked a number of times, and I don't know if there's really an answer, so I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm just curious. I think when it comes to particularly UFO researchers or any of this kind of paranormal, there's always the idea of the other, of them, or they, or something else, where a lot of the academics, the psychoanalysts, they come to the idea that this is an expression of you, is an expression of your mind. Even the mystical schools are going to say the same thing. This is all a product of you. I think the better mystical schools will say that it is a combination of you and everyone else, that there is a higher, and there is an environment, there are other beings, there are other life forces, etc. But what I'm trying to get at is there seems to be very often this almost reductionism down to it's all in your head, which on one level, I can dig that. But on another level, I think that we have to acknowledge other, just as you and I on some metaphysical level are one, everyone on this call, we are all one. Yes, that is true. And yet there is something that makes us each individual and unique. So does this, in my mind, this kind of translates over where I think the UFO research is so valuable here is because it's kind of investigating, well, what is this other? Is it something that is unique and individual to itself? And is that, you know, I guess what I'm saying is it a communication with your inner subconscious mind, or is it a communication with some thing else? Fill in the blank, of course.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you're just, this is a bottomless pit of mystery here, you know, where the UFO abductee, I mean, I've sort of immersed myself in the literature, and I can't even begin to tell you how many books I've read, and one of the reoccurring stories that shows up is that when the abductee, it doesn't happen with everyone, but when the abductee, let's say, is on a craft, they take on a completely different persona. They take on a completely different personality. They are in a mode where they may be in a place where they're like, oh, like they remember. It's almost like they have a completely different past life where they remember all the requirements of being on these ships and their duties, and they just step into that role where they're quite often they're even wearing a uniform like that matches the uniform of the aliens, and they will have a duty. So oftentimes that duty is just calming down other abductees that are freaking out. That's a very common thing to hear. And some researchers will refer to these. There's a guy, Joe Montaldo, who refers to this little sub-chapter or sub-identity of within the literature, the lore, as the keepers. And so they literally have, you know, it's not even so much they're tapping into another identity. They've actually almost, you could say they've created an entirely new identity. Then the chicken and the egg thing comes up, like, which is the first identity? Like, did the persona of the completely even keeled team member of the aliens, you know, the comrade of the aliens, someone with a sort of almost militaristic duty on board these crafts, did that person come first and somehow get reincarnated into the person here on Earth who has only fleeting memories of interacting with these aliens? But when they do have those memories, it shows up that they're actually, you know, in cahoots in a very, and it's not like they're in cahoots, like they're a prisoner in a, you know, responding to, you know, like, you know, work on the chain gang, like they're forced to do this work. They are completely willing and completely at peace with their role.
Almost as if like a sort of sweeper cell agent, we might say, kind of, oh, you've come here to learn about the Earthlings, and you just kind of, you get so immersed in the role that while you're in the role, you actually forget that you're on a mission, sort of thing.
Sure, and that shows up in all kinds of mythologies, too. You know, that yeah. shows up in, you know, I can't remember who it was, like someone in ancient Egyptian mythology, like came down from the gods and learned to live on Earth and immediately lost themselves in the seductive physical qualities that we have here on Earth. You know, whether that's sex or eating food or, you know, love of children or something like that, they forget that they were once gods.
Yeah. That's in the creation myth of the divine Pymander, where basically the Egyptian version of the Adam, so to speak, goes through the seven rings and then forgets how, like, it doesn't understand how to get back, and then basically just forgets himself in the material existence. So a divine being descends.
Oh, very, yeah. Very Gnostic. That's the Sophia, same story. But I was wondering if there wasn't, is it fair to say it could go the other way? That it's when you say on this craft, it's as if they were someone else. Would it be fair to say, almost like a dream? I've had many dreams where in the dream I'm actually not Alan, or there's this whole other backstory to the dream that you kind of, in this dream logic, you already know. You know the backstory. Oh, I'm here working as a construction worker on, you know, some ridiculous thing, that you have the full story of the dream. Is that a fair thing, that it could go the other way? That
sure, that's a great analogy. Yeah, and I mean, I've experienced that myself in dream realm.
So I like your... Oh, I'm sorry. Alan? Or, okay, I had a interaction at one point a few years ago with this man who had actually cured himself of AIDS. He had AIDS, and he was diagnosed with such, and he went through this whole process, and he had a big impact on me. Very, very intense guy who did tons and tons and tons of yoga, which comes to mind because in your article, I really liked how you had mentioned the yoga side of it towards the end in terms of possibility of higher consciousness and whatnot, whether by abduction or this. And he basically looked at these, he emphasized his interactions with extraterrestrials as intelligences. And he was basically expressing that the form in which we see them in his eyes was basically the mind's best way of communicating those intelligences, that was a representation for us to understand. And he was also emphasizing these things as not separate from us, that alien is a very it's not the appropriate word in this context, because it's ultimately not outside of ourselves, and that these are actually can work through us. And he basically, using this understanding, had actually gone through this whole purification process and baffled the medical world with what he did with that, and would actually like basically scan himself from within and do all kinds of yoga exercises. And he was intense. He would eat completely raw, juiced a ton, and just did loads and loads of yoga, but then was all on this extraterrestrial tip, which I found very, very interesting.
So the line in the essay about the yogic practices, that came from a guy named Daryl Anka, who channels a entity who he claims to be, I think I called it an alien entity or something like that in the text, but he actually, it's his future self coming back, you know, after multiple reincarnations. You know, and the future self has since been through some sort of hybridization process. So the future self is like a telepathic hybrid alien channeling back in time through Daryl Anka. And then Daryl Anka has also had, I think in 1973, he had two really profound close-up UFO sightings. And then he started channeling this entity Bashar after those close-up UFO sightings. He gave that definition of synchronicity that I really liked. I wouldn't be able to do it right now. I'd have to paraphrase it. But he definitely, he said, you know, like, oh, it's not like just, you know, the synchronicity isn't just limited to the alien abductee. And I think that was my question, you know, like, why do alien abductees seem to have all this synchronicity, you know, more than other people? He said, anyone that's opened to, you know, expanded consciousness will have more synchronicities. And then he listed off a few things. And one of them was the person who's, dedicated themselves to yogic practices. And And I've also find that people with near-death experiences have a lot of synchronicities, which makes perfect sense given that definition, you know. But yeah, so I mean that story of a guy curing himself of AIDS is remarkable on one sense, but at the same sense, you know, like just the power of intention is can be profoundly intense. And I that doesn't surprise me that someone, you know, the fact that you called him so intense and that he was so dedicated to yoga and his diet and things like that, I think, you know, that just speaks to his intention.
Yeah, there's another side to this that he had mentioned, and that I had experienced a lot of sleep paralysis in my life, where basically lucid sleep paralysis, where I in the middle of the night I'm dreaming, I'm hallucinating in the dream realm, and I know that I'm laying there and I'm not able to move. And I had a friend who suffered night terrors and was looking at the message boards and said that a lot of people who'd experienced this that he saw on these message boards had looked at that as an abduction until they came across this. And I've had times with sleep paralysis where when my breathing gets extremely restricted and feels like it's going on for almost like an eternity, like I can just breathe into it, you know, and I've released into it before and had complete not able to count for time. Time is completely out the window. Everything's completely out the window. And when I come to, I don't know what happened. I can see with that happening how somebody could interpret that as an abduction thing, especially if your mind is going to create a story around it lucidly, in a sense, you know, not being able to move, first off, being, you know, constrained in that way. And so I've related to it on that level, and then also considered, I had a teacher, Babahari Das, who basically expressed that with yoga practices, the reason why lotus is so emphasized is actually because the yogi can often go into a state of paralysis, which is really what you're striving for, and that the higher states are always achieved in a state of paralysis. And so I've considered that in my own mind in terms of abduction. Do you have anything to say to that?
Well, I mean, that's there's a blurry line between these spiritual practices and the abduction lore. I mean, you know, on one sense, you know, there's plenty of in the literature, and I've talked to people, you know, there's plenty of stories where people have abduction experiences where they're out in a car, or they're walking in a field, or they're, you know, standing in their kitchen and they turn around and suddenly they're thrust into some sort of abduction experience. So that night visitation, you know, is what we, you know, think about when we sort of try to frame alien abduction in our minds. But yeah, so that blending of all these spiritual practices shows up. I mean, it's there's more than one, you know, I can't really speak to yogic practices or like Eastern religion, but one of the things that shows up, and I think I've read three accounts. I know for sure there are two, and both these two are illustrated by the people who had the account. One of them is Betty Andreasen, and the other one is a guy named David Huggins. And both of them have drawn their accounts, and they're in the books. But they had an account where they were subjected, like in the presence of the gray aliens on board in a ship environment. They are somehow, the gray aliens produce a outer body experience, and then they go through a tunnel, and then they, you know, are standing in front of a giant eagle, and the giant eagle, and that this is pretty, the account that Betty Andreasen gives us is pretty chilling. I mean, it's and the eagle lights on fire, you know, burns, you know, like they actually talk about, you know, feeling the heat in the presence of the giant eagle as it burns, it reduces to ashes. And then from those ashes, a giant golden eagle appears. And, you know, these accounts are intensely emotional when people share them. And I mean, that is, you know, that's the phoenix bird that shows up in both Mediterranean cultures as well as in Native American cultures. You know, it's perfect. And is that just like a universal experience that some people are subjected to, and they have that experience and then they retell it? You know, like which comes first, the alien abduction or the enlightening religious experience?
Right.
Do you know there's this Castaneda books? There was one where, isn't it something like at the almost the edge of the universe is this kind of mirror or projector of the holographic matrix, and there's some giant eagle at the edge there. Just throwing that out, that's sort of really interesting to me that this is how people would confront, for lack of a better term, confront the abyss and see this thing, which is both death and rebirth. It's a sort of yin and yang. It's a mirror of itself, and that to be confronted with that sort of overwhelming beauty. And that's so interesting to me to have someone have this experience which crosses the line into the spiritual realm in a very literal, almost hallucinogenic way, as opposed to thinking that you're on board a spaceship and then realizing later in life that this is, for lack of a better term, it is a spiritual path. I think that's interesting to see that there are experiences that kind of cross over into this hallucinatory realm. Do you think is that common in the literature?
To some extent, sure. You know, and oftentimes people will even say, like, you know, like, oh gosh, I'm like confronted with this holographic experience, and like I'm confronted with this virtual reality experience. So they won't even mince words. You know, they'll say, as opposed to like, I really experienced this. And that's actually what David Huggins and Betty Andreasen say when they talk about, you know, seeing this phoenix bird, you know, light on fire and then crumble to ashes and you know, the whole metaphor there. But what they'll say is like, oh, you know, like I was, here was this holographic projection, and the one that just shows up over and over and over again, and is so commonplace that you know, like I almost skip past it when in reading this stuff, is like sort of end of the world scenarios, like apocalyptic scenarios, like, you know, the Book of Revelation scenarios. And they will say that, you know, oh, it was holographic, you know, like it started off like on a screen. And the next thing that happened is I felt like I was within the screen and I could smell things and I could feel the wind. And I was seeing things from, you know, like grand sort of godlike, you know, like I was out in space looking down at Earth as Earth, like, you know, was subjected to, you know, all these explosions. So there is that line, whether it's a holographic projection or whether it's a you know, like a something that they actually truly felt and experienced.
Now this is interesting because I actually wanted to ask you. Chris Knowles has mentioned that at the end of 2001: A Space Odyssey, that white room. He said that bright white room is something very common that people report in these experiences. But now if you tie that in with a apocalyptic scenario where someone enters the screen, which the common idea is that the monolith of 2001: A Space Odyssey is meant to represent the movie screen. So the idea of going into the screen and then becoming out in space and being this sort of godlike thing looking over, is that not the Star Child?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things, the beautiful things about 2001 is that ending is so sparse. I mean, there's really not that much that goes on, you know, as opposed to, you know, like other movies that like hammer you over the head with stuff. I'm thinking of, Jacob's Ladder just had so much imagery and it was just so rapid fire that you know, you have all kinds of meat to work with if you want to make analogies. But the imagery at the end of 2001 is so sparse that the imagery almost or the metaphors that you come up with can be that much more profound. You know, that was Jay Widener that came up with the aspect ratio of the Cinerama screen was the same proportions as the monolith. So, you know, the thought is that, and that's why I can't remember what it's called, like the beta state or something like that. They like the people, they hook people up to little brain sensors, and they sit them down in front of a television set. And beta state is like the state that you're most receptive to hypnosis in. I think I'm telling this right. And it takes like, you know, you would think like you would ask someone, how long would it take you to get to that beta state and get hypnotized, you know, sitting in front of a television set? And people will say like, oh, it would take 2 hours or something like that. And then it happens in like 20 seconds. So whatever's going on, and that's what makes Hollywood so weirdly addicting, you know, is that the the storytelling, the screen, the projected images, the fact that you have to sit there and be quiet and stare at the screen, you know, creates this hypnosis effect in the individual. And I mean, whatever, it's whatever, when the movie's bad, it ain't that, it doesn't, you know, not much happens. But when the movie is transcendent, you know, like 2001, you know, like that experience can be intense, you know. And I mean, whatever, that 2001 was infamous for, you know, when it came out in 1968, for people to, like, you know, drop acid and then see it, you know. So that was kind of the mystique of the whole film, is that, you know, you were already like two steps down the path, you know, towards that hallucinogenic experience just by seeing the movie on its own.
I like that a lot. Yeah. Over as time passes, it seems to me that, you know, adding LSD into 2001 is mm-hmm. just overkill, you know, that, like, I mean, LSD is going to do what it's going to do, and 2001 is going to do what it's going to do. And I don't know, to combine them, I don't know. It almost seems too much. And I agree with what you're saying, is that the film itself is a joint hallucination. We're just sort of blind to it because most of us were born into it, you know? I always like to say that, like, you know, a kid born today, how many hours of TV have they watched before they've learned how to read? And that's a complete anomaly as to human development, you know.
Oh,
what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
Especially the way with the screen and the way that the light is focused, I always kind of think of it as like a flashlight, and that you, when you put it in front of a human face, they just become attached to it, like magnetically. It's almost like the lights of a supposed UFO that beam you up, you know. It just grabs a hold of your brain and abducts you. I kind of take that TV film abduction analogy to Aleister Crowley's depiction of Lom, the first artistic description of this sort of classic gray alien, right? With the large head and the dark eyes.
Sure.
Yeah. And I kind of think of the Lom that Crowley was depicting was a play on lamb, and that TV was the new way to herd the sheep, that the sheep would sit on couches in front of the screen and they would become all gray matter and dark eyes, because all they're using is their brain and their eyes, and that they're tuning out all other aspects of their physical body. And that you could basically chop off their arms and legs and their torso, but as long as they had their eyes and their brain, they could remain on that couch forever. And that it was this laser-like abduction that was about to be unleashed upon the masses, or was just starting to become unleashed on the masses. And I don't think it's any coincidence or too far of a stretch that one of the first instances of television being used was in Nazi Germany, when Hitler rolled televisions into villages in the countryside so that they could watch the Olympic Games. Which just is fascinating to me. I mean, I can't think of anything more insane than being a villager and someone wheeling in this contraption that allowed you to watch something happening live. Well, I don't even know if it was live. I don't know, but that's really powerful technology. And to think that you have to throw powerful chemicals like LSD in order to really enhance it is kind of missing the point, or losing the point, that the thing itself is right there, you know. Very bizarre.
Sure. Yeah. And but, you know, all that said is that, you know, it was, believe me, there were a lot of people that dropped acid in 1968 and went to see that movie, you know. And, you know, so, you know, that was the era where, like, LSD was, you know, easily available. And, you know, when you get into the conspiracy theories of, you know, what, you know, did the government, you know, purposely invent LSD to flood the populace with LSD as like some sort of giant social experiment, mind control experiment. And then, are you familiar with the TV show Dark Skies?
I am not.
The 90s, there's Bryce Zabel, who's written a book with Richard Dolan, who's a UFO researcher, came up with the show and was executive producer, and it ran for only one season. But it was just, it was like a crazy conglomeration of every conceivable nutty conspiracy theory all threaded together in this show with, you know, UFO abductees, like, you know, trying to outwit the secret government. And, but one of the things that they did is, you know, they basically, it took place in the 1960s. So it starts off with the Kennedy assassination being tied into UFO abduction and UFO secrets. But they just went through all the events of the 1960s and created a little sub, you know, almost comical, you know, plots. But one of them was that when the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan, it was actually a giant government mind control experiment, which is pretty bold for network TV.
Yeah, I was going to say, what network was this on? That's pretty...
It was on NBC.
That's crazy.
Totally, it was totally, like, you know, above board, you know.
But, yeah, and NBC being the biggest arms manufacturer.
Oh, because they're in tied in with...
GE, right?
GE, yeah.
Now, so, see, that's fascinating. But I want to say, both to the TV and the LSD, it seems to me that you could have a backlash. Even if it is a control mechanism, it's also these children who are growing up with so much TV, we do see that it's creating this dumbing down effect. We do see a lot of ill effects of it. And yet there's also, if a child who hasn't yet learned to read has learned how to speak in this language of metaphor and symbolism that TV, by its very nature, has to speak in, that the idea of stories, the idea of imagery, that you are learning another language. So, of course, there's room for control there, but there's also, just as with LSD, you can't control someone's LSD experience. You can give them something, you can try and coerce them in a certain way, but ultimately, it's set in setting their... what the experience that they bring to it, whatever's in their mind, is also going to shape that experience. So I think there's a sort of double-edged sword here, and that's my only sort of shining light in this, in some of these realms, is that we do see that artwork, not most television is not high art, but nonetheless, there is a bright side to it. I don't know. That's fascinating to me.
No, it's fascinating just because, you know, that show existed at all. I have not seen the show. I don't, you know, I remember when it came out, but, you know, I've seen, you know, there's episodes that are online and I've watched, you know, a few of the episodes.
Oh, sorry. I just remembered what I was, so I don't know if this is, if anyone's ever paid attention to this before, but there's a piece of information I've come across that I've not seen elsewhere that I want to drop in, because you said the show starts with the Kennedy assassination. And that's basically what I've been knee-deep in for the last year, is all the strange synchronicities around the Kennedy assassination. And if I don't know if you're familiar with a guy, James Shelby Downer, this
sure.
idea, King Kill 33. Okay. So he ties in the idea of the Trinity experiments to the Kennedy assassination. Now, the other thing we would know is that you have the first atomic bomb explosion, and then, what is it, 2 years later, almost in the exact same place, you have Roswell. Very, very close proximity, incredibly close proximity to the Trinity site is where the Roswell incident happens.
And you could just go, but, you know, like that it's maybe less a conspiracy and more just the fact that, you know, the Roswell conspiracy or the Roswell event happened at, I can't remember what the Army Air Base, what the
right.
name, or the Roswell Army Air Base. Yeah. So, and that was the only air base that actually had nuclear bombs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ready to go. So, like in 1947, you know, the only place that they had nuclear bombs connected to airplanes was in Roswell Army Air Base. So, you know, that would obviously be happening just because that the remote location of New Mexico there.
Sure, and you have the idea that there's a very common correlation between aliens and atomic weapons. Perhaps the idea that aliens, I've seen a number of reports that people say UFOs hovering over nuclear arms sites, and that this idea of that they want to prevent atomic war and different things like that. This is a very common message and meme that gets put out about UFOs connected to atomic bombs.
Absolutely, so, yeah. There's a fellow named Robert Hastings who wrote a book called UFOs and Nukes, and he had a press conference in Washington, D.C. probably 3 years ago that you could watch online. It's pretty interesting, where he just one credible witness after another standing in front of the camera, you know, giving their accounts.
So here's the tidbit that I want to drop out there that I don't know if anyone's come across before. Because I've been so into this idea of this connection between Kennedy and the assassination and these atomic bombs, and then I was going through different atomic tests, even the bombing at Nagasaki. There's all these really strange correlations between all these. So following a sort of hunch, I looked through the reports of every atomic bomb test that the U.S. has ever done to see if there was one performed on the day of Kennedy's assassination, and there was. So all these tests have strange names, like, you know, just code names, Project Cherokee, Project Tomahawk, Project whatever, you know, Baker, Abel, all these different things. But the day of Kennedy's assassination, within an hour, I believe, it was actually an hour after the assassination, which is kind of strange to me that the President of the United States was just killed and we're going to go on with our test. I don't know why I think everything government would sort of come to a halt, but it just still seems odd to me. Regardless, the name of the test is GREYS, plural, G-R-E-Y-S. That's the atomic bomb that went off an hour after Kennedy is killed, is Project GREYS.
Wow.